Thanks much, Dave, for your fine musicianship, as always. Our first reading is by Reverend John Dietrich, a leading humanist preacher a century ago, one of the signers of the Humanist Manifesto. He served the Unitarian Society in Minneapolis over two decades. I'm going to read from a letter that Reverend Dietrich wrote in the year before he died. These are not the words of a strident orator. They've taken on some seasoned experience. Dietrich writes, "My philosophy and religion have undergone considerable revision. I realize now how my utter reliance upon science and reason and my contempt for any intuitive insights and intangible values was a great mistake. The way in which I cut humanity off from all cosmic relationships, denying or ignoring every influence outside of humanity itself, was very short-sighted and arrogant. I have come now to believe that we cannot ignore the power behind the phenomena, or God, if you please. I hesitate to use that term because of the connotations which it might suggest to some, but much reading and reflection have convinced me of the reality of a spiritual power. I would hesitate to define it or explain its workings, but I believe that we can experience its presence, bring ourselves into harmony with it, and find our lives enriched and energized. The world today needs, above all else, spiritual integrity, which science cannot and does not pretend to furnish. Religion should seek to develop this awareness. It flowers into what we call the spiritual life and into the ethical and human values. Humanism had value as a protest movement, with its emphasis upon human betterment, but its day has passed. It should be replaced by a more mature attitude toward the universe and human existence." John Dietrich. A second short reading. This is a reflection on the global economic collapse from a decade ago. And the writer is focusing on some of the human consequences of this global meltdown. He says, "You know, this might be a touch more forgiving if economists didn't display such relentlessly high confidence in their own correctness. How can we simple folk now bear the absence of authority coming from this army of experts? What will life be like for us now without their telling us with bluffing precision the financial lay of the land?" Bluffing precision. "The experts, very smart," says Epstein, "but I fear that they are insufficiently impressed by and humbled by the mysteries of life." On the front cover of your service, Mukhtar Mai. She will be a focus of our conversations today. A little more about her in a few moments. This is about the best of humanism. The best. You know, my colleague Forrester Church claims, "I'm proudly claiming a humanist label for myself. Because, you know, humanism is a modest word. The origin of the words humble, human, humane, humus, it's the same Latin root. It means dust, earth, dust to dust, earth to earth. This is a very humble tone. The mortar of our mortality is what binds us to one another, to our loved ones and adversaries. The same sun will rise and set over all. And in this sense, humanists reaffirm that we are indeed one. One in our need to be linked in redemptive community. Consider how our humanist tradition has evolved over the last century or so. The original statement from 1933 was uncompromising, positive. Rational laws of cause and effect were the universal pacemakers of change. And smart people should simply use these laws to get through life's challenges. There is no room in this original statement for those folks who may be troubled, hesitant, suffering, weak, or faint of heart. There's no room for such behavior. There is also no room for the affective, relational, spiritual dimensions of life. Manifesto 1 is for strong people who want to get even better at being strong. Fine. Manifesto 2 emerged in 1973, following four decades of wake-up calls beyond the strident optimism of earlier. The wake-up calls from Auschwitz and Buchenwald and Hiroshima to the Gulag and McCarthyism and Vietnam and dozens of others. Manifesto 2 brought in many more voices, not just old white men like me who had composed Manifesto 1. Manifesto 2 was more than three times as long. And it is, in a way, a laundry list of social and political principles and programs. Action. Well over 1,000 signatures compared to, I think, 32 who signed the original. 1,000 participants in this sobering up call of the early 1970s. And in so doing, it recognized that the earlier presumption about the inevitable success of human reason, that was a little bit of overclaiming. Then Manifesto 3 came along in the brutal aftermath of 9/11. It's quite short. Quite short. All of a sudden, 19 guys with box cutters could change the course of history. Manifesto 3 was quite pointed. And it brought in matters of the heart. Matters of the heart. So what might be some of the expressions of humanism at its best as we go forward, not only in our culture, but in Mukhtar Mai's culture and cultures around the world? Expressions of the voices of women and those marginalized, as well as those who may be temporarily at the top of a pyramid of privilege. What might the humanism incorporate of multiple voices? I'd suggest a couple of dimensions, starting with humility. I may still have something to learn. There may be folks off stage who need to be invited into this conversation. Some of you may remember a few years ago when our UUA president, Bill Sinkford, invited us to cultivate a language of reverence. Bill caught a lot of flack for using that word, as you might expect, because for some folks, reverence might mean superstition or groveling before some deity or something that's not down to earth. But reverence is simply humility. It is a profoundly human virtue. It's recognizing that the cosmos does not revolve around little me, and it is releasing one's clenched, fisted grip to open one's hands to amazement. That's all reverence is. It's not superstition, and it's not on some other planet. It is very immediate to our experience. The humanism that is emerging must be radically relational. Radically relational. Yes, we have individual choices, and responsibilities, and we do this in the interactive and checking, correcting experience of a redemptive community. It's no longer sufficient to go the way of, I go my way, you go your way, and if we happen to bump together, that's neat. That is no longer sufficient. That is not sufficient. And finally, our humanism needs to be grounded in responsibility and in the courage. In the courage to make a difference. What do I mean by courage? I'm going to talk about that in the context of one woman, Mukhtar Mai. She lived in lives in a small village in Pakistan. Mukhtar Mai, some of you who were in our ethics class last Sunday will remember that we referred to Mukhtar Mai. Her words and her story bear repeating right now. Mukhtar was a peasant girl in a small village when her 12-year-old brother was falsely accused of raping the daughter of a landowner. The chief of the landowner clan ordered four of his henchmen to gang rape Mukhtar as a retribution. And so they did. For more than an hour, on the floor of a stable, and the other three waiting outside with shotguns would force Mukhtar's father and brother to be nearby when she was tossed out following her debasement. Mukhtar recounts that day, when they are finished with me, I am thrown outside on the ground where my father and brother are waiting. My clothes are torn. I am nearly naked. I lie on the ground along with my shame. In that 1 hour on the stable floor, my life has been destroyed. For several days afterward, no one spoke to Mukhtar about what had happened to her, and she spoke to no one. In Pakistan, Mukhtar explains, women do not talk about such degrading things with anyone else. Some women stay home and never mention it again. Others kill themselves. Is this what I should do? In Pakistan, staying alive is seen by some as more cowardly and shameful than the rape itself. But if I don't commit suicide, what then shall I do with the rest of my life? Mukhtar wondered. Mukhtar soon learned that her rape was not just the plot of this cadre of landowners. Her rape had been ordered by the town council as a so-called honor revenge. Honor revenge is something that sadly pops up in parts of the world. And in Pakistan, where honor rapes and killings are not unusual, thousands of Pakistani women die every year from honor killings. Almost every one of these, by the way, is at the hand of another family member. Now, there's an inspiring part of Mukhtar's story, and that's what we're going to move into. Two people unexpectedly met Mukhtar's courage with courage of their own. Mukhtar was alone. Two others met her courage with their courage and came to their aid. The local imam and a judge. Now, the local imam, in one of his Friday sermons, told his congregation, "The village council has sinned greatly in ordering this violation of Islamic law. The criminals responsible for the rape must be brought to justice. Mukhtar Mai and her family should go to the police and file charges immediately." So said the imam to his congregation on a Friday. Mukhtar had never heard of the Constitution. She did not realize that women had any legal rights. And yet, even so, her father and her brothers did go with her to file charges. Eventually, she appeared before a judge. The judge asked Mukhtar to describe every detail of what had happened to her on the floor of the stable. So she did. As the judge bore witness to the tragedy of her suffering, he gave voice to her cry for help. Before she left the courtroom, the judge told Mukhtar to hold fast to your courage, because the judge knew how explosive her testimony would eventually be. He knew her danger, but he encouraged her, hold fast. Almost overnight, a commonplace rape involving a voiceless peasant girl in a nameless village, it became a national scandal in Pakistan and eventually an international outrage. Today, Mukhtar is using the money which she received from the judgment against her rapists. She is using that money to fund the operation of a school and a clinic in her village. Now, in Mukhtar's case, it took the courage of three people to change the world. It took a rape victim who decided not to give up, an imam who decided to speak out, and a judge who decided to listen. And while individually their actions were indeed courageous, they weren't trying to be dramatic or heroic or call attention to themselves. They were simply doing what was right. Mukhtar stood up. The imam spoke out. The judge listened. My colleague Galen Gingrich notes that courage, you know, it has two manifestations. Manifestations of, indeed, humanism at its best, and that's what we're about today. Courage has two essential dimensions. Courage is, first of all, the ability to see evil close at hand and to take steps to confront it, to speak out, despite obvious dangers. And courage has a second dimension. Courage is also the ability to envision goodness and love and transformation over the horizon. To see good afar off and to take steps toward it despite the risks. Because to experience this kind of courage is to know an internal calling that is greater than the fear. And you can bet that in so many situations that demand the best of our humanity, there's going to be a tinge or a boatload of fear associated with it. You can bet it's going to be lurking or a terrifying phantom. But the key is to focus Not on the fear, not on the phantoms, not on the trolls under the bridge, real or imagined, but on the calling itself, the calling toward the best of who we can be. You know, friends, I don't know what calling, what goodness, what opportunities each of you may be conjuring up and imagining and even have on your calendars for today and next week and so forth. But whatever your directions toward goodness might be in your workplace, in your retirement, most anywhere, whatever calling you are feeling is going to be accompanied by, oh my goodness, what if? It's the fear factor. But despite the fear, the challenge is going to be to say yes to the calling. You know, Mary Oliver observes in her poem, The Journey, that the voice you hear saying yes is a voice that you will slowly recognize as your own. The voice that you hear saying yes is not some magician, it is your own voice. It will keep you company as you stride deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you can do, determined to save the only life you can save, which is your own. Have courage. Looking ahead, what might our courage be here in Greater Williamsburg? Courage to hold, to care for, to bear witness, and to bless one another. I'll be eager to return and eavesdrop, and to be knocked over in amazement by this best of our humanity and all that is our life.